in Holland, there was a Dutch minister who needed a bell like this to keep order. It didn't last longer than 6 months. So I don't know what this tells. Anyway. We finished some quite complicated issues this morning, and now we have just two thin papers on impairment. We have all afternoon. We don't necessarily have to use the whole afternoon. No, we don't need the whole afternoon. I think we're going to start with the discussion about transfer between buckets. Jana, are you going to lead us through this? Thank you.
Okay, so agenda paper 7A is what we'll discuss. In the June meeting, you decided to continue to develop the three-bucket expected loss approach for impairment of financial assets with a guiding principle to reflect the general pattern of deterioration in credit quality of loans. The different phases of credit deterioration or of deterioration in credit quality are captured through three buckets that determines the allowance balance. At that same meeting, you decided that the allowance balance for buckets two and for bucket three would be the remaining lifetime expected credit losses. So today, ISB Memo 7A and FASB Memo 100 will be discussed, and it outlines possible approaches to determine how assets are allocated to each bucket and when assets are transferred between bucket 1, 2, and 3. The question of measurement and timing and recognition of expected credit losses is addressed in the Memo 7B and FASB Memo 101, and that will be discussed later. Before going into or turning to accounting to the Memo 7A, I would like to point out that there is some interaction between the two papers, and that is if the boards are concerned with the adequacy of the allowance balance, the quicker loans of deteriorating credit quality move out of bucket one, so are transferred to bucket two, arguably the lower the allowance balance that needs to be established for bucket one. I would also like to recap. In the July meeting, we discussed the guiding principle to reflect the pattern of deterioration in credit quality. And we thought that this at this meeting, we said that this could be reflected as follows. Loans would be moving from being in a pool of loans newly originated or purchased with no known default evidence to being included in a pool with heightened credit risk, but where expected credit losses for individual loans cannot be identified. And then ultimately, it would move to loans for which expected credit losses can be individually identified. At that meeting, the discussion focused very much on the types of information that would cause such a transfer to occur. The boards noted the importance to develop clear and well-defined indicators and guidance as to when such a transfer between the buckets should occur, and you directed us to develop the criteria for the three buckets. So that was a long introduction. Now I would like to go into agenda paper 7A, and I would like to discuss the general approaches, and I will walk you through those approaches. We also distributed some slides. Do you all have them? I hope so. Okay, great. One point I would like to note, though, is a scoping issue, and that is that in the March meeting 2011, you decided that loans that are acquired at a discount due to credit losses that would be recognized in the bad book, that the integrated effective interest rate would be calculated, and that no allowance should be established on initial recognition. This is a treatment that is different from all other loans. So all I would like to say is that once we develop a model, we believe we need to come back and look at the appropriate bucket allocation for those types of loans. So that's just a scope issue to set the scene. And then I would like now to go into the two approaches. The first approach is an event-based approach, and the second approach that I laid out in the agenda paper 7A and FASB Memo 100 is credit risk management approach. Today we would like to get your direction as to which of those approaches we should develop further. So now if we are turning and looking at the slides now, and I would like to mention that I would appreciate if we could go through the slides first, and then we are very welcome to open for questions and to answer any questions, so that would be helpful. So slide one. Slide one shows an event-based approach, and this approach was an attempt to develop the examples that we used in the last board meeting in June. And we try to identify what types of information should cause a transfer between the buckets. Under this approach, all loans would be initially or start out in bucket one, and transfers of loans across buckets would occur based on specific events that indicate the existence or indicate the existence of credit deterioration or of credit improvement. If you look at slide one, it shows the alternative ways we considered to implement the event-based approach. On the left-hand side, you can see the alternatives we considered, and in those situations, the loss information in bucket one would just be updated. So what I mean by this is that it would affect the amount of the losses recognized in bucket one if those events occur, but it would not trigger a move to bucket two. On the right-hand side of the slides, you can see the events that would trigger the move out of bucket one. As staff, we struggle to identify a principle that differentiate events and changes in circumstances that would require transfer between buckets from those that would not. We also learned during our primarily outreach activities that firms employ multi-factor models to estimate expected credit losses, and so they look at credit risk holistically. So entities don't focus on just single events and the effect of that particular event. Another significant concern of the event-based approach that is that we believe it can act as a barrier to recognition of impairment losses, and that is apparent in the incurred loss model we have today. So given these concerns, we considered two possible alternative approaches, and these approaches are based on credit risk management practices. There we have an absolute credit risk model and a relative credit risk model. But before I go into the details of these models, I would just also like to point out that when we developed those approaches, we very much developed it from having corporate loans in mind. And so I would like to point this out because we will need to investigate in more detail how these models would apply for consumer loans or for debt securities. But the aim would be that we develop a principle and categorizations for each bucket that can be applied for all asset classes. Both the absolute and the relative model, they use aspects of credit risk management practices. So we hope by doing so we will be able to develop a model that's simpler for entities to operationalize. Conceptually, we also believe that this sits well with the credit deterioration the boards are trying to capture. So I will present both these individual models first, and then I will highlight the differences between them. So if you could go to the next slide, that would be slide two. The best way to explain the allocation of the loans between the buckets is to consider the credit risk of the loan, which is indicated by the red arrow. So you would have loans of the best credit quality that are in bucket one and loans that have the worst credit quality that would be in bucket three. Loans so would be categorized based on their credit quality in this approach. And all loans of equal credit quality will be in the same bucket. So when you consider about the situations when loans are originated or purchased, and obviously also over its life, and those loans would be put into those buckets according to its credit risk. So this means that newly originated or purchased loans with high credit risk, such as, for example, microloans or certain leveraged finance loans, would be classified to bucket two with the lifetime expected credit losses recognized in the first period, and that's even though interest charge would reflect the inherent high credit risk of the loan. In the absolute model, at the end of each reporting period, the loans are classified according to its new level of credit risk. And so loans can migrate upwards or downwards depending on how the what the credit risk of the loan is. In terms of entities that would apply if we would go for such a model, entities would need to map their existing credit rating categories to these three buckets. So entities might have less categories than three, or they might have much more categories than three. So what will be very important is that we need to establish guidance for each of the buckets to operationalize this and to ensure to get the best possible comparability. So if we move now to the next slide, that is the relative model. The relative model is based on changes in credit risk. So that's a deterioration or improvement in loans. So it's not the absolute level of credit risk, it's a change in credit risk. Under this approach, all loans, whether they are originated or purchased, start out in bucket one, and that's irrespective of the level of its credit risk. And this is because the loss expectations are embedded in the prices. In this approach, in the relative approach, those loans move out of bucket one when the credit deteriorates. So then they are transferred out of bucket one, so to bucket two or potentially to bucket three. As a result of this, as all loans would start in bucket one would have loans of varying credit quality. It is very important that if we think about the relative credit risk model, we mean relative credit deterioration in credit quality, and that this model would not require to track loans from its origination. So rather what we mean is that an entity would have to see if it's if the loan deteriorated in credit quality compared to the last period, and whether this deterioration occurred to such an extent that it is necessary for these loans to transfer out of bucket one to bucket two or to bucket three. Again, in this model, as in the absolute model, the loans can migrate upwards or downwards depending on the credit quality. So subsequently, improvements in credit qualities or deteriorations in credit quality. So again, this model also, you have movements upwards or downwards depending on the situation. If we now go to the last slide, because the last slide now summarizes the differences between the relative and the absolute credit model. So in the absolute credit risk model, the buckets, as I explained earlier, are defined by the credit risk of the loan. In the relative model, it is based on changes in credit risk or expected recoverability of cash flows. So the absolute model aligns the accounting and the credit risk management practices, and it means that loans in each bucket are of equal credit quality. The relative model also uses aspects of credit risk management practices to the extent that credit changes in credit risks and are monitored, so for example through a watch list. We have done already some initial outreach to see whether these approaches are likely to be operational. An impairment approach that aligns with the accounting with credit risk management practices obviously is operational, the simplest to implement. A model that is based on relative credit risk introduces incremental complexity because it requires a period comparison. Entities there would need to track whether a loan becomes riskier compared to the previous period. But the feedback we have received so far is that also this, while this is more complex, it is possible to compare the current credit rating to the previous period's credit rating in order to determine whether the credit risk has heightened. One of the main differences between the models is that the absolute credit risk in this model, the loans would be allocated to the respective bucket upon origination or purchase based on its credit risk. And if it's a loan that is originated or purchased with high credit risk, it would be recognized in bucket two, and in the first period, lifetime expected credit losses would be established. A loan in the relative model, loans only then transfer to the bucket two if they had a deterioration in credit quality. So all loans start out in bucket one. And I would like to mention here that this is an important distinction that will vary by jurisdiction and by the types of loans and entity rights. But it's one of the main distinctions between the two models. Before I turn to the board discussion, I would like to note that the staff recommends to further develop the credit risk management approaches, so that's approach 2A and 2B, based on the problems mentioned earlier in respect to the event-based approach. So we are not requesting the boards to vote on whether an absolute credit risk model or a relative credit risk model is preferred. Rather, we would like to continue to do our outreach activity to help determine whether those models can be applied in an operational, feasible manner. So, accordingly, our questions to the board are in paragraph 55 and are asking you whether you agree with the general direction that the staff should develop the credit risk management approach, and if not, what direction you would like us to pursue. And based on the information that we provided, if you have a preference whether all originated loans should be classified to bucket one or if it should be permissible to classify originated loans directly into bucket two or three. So, yes.
Okay, let's start our deliberations. Philippe?
Before we do that, there is a point in the presentation of the slides which creates a potential for confusion. If you look at the slide on relative credit risk model, bucket 2, transfers, little a, a deterioration in financial performance of the borrower, singular, gives you an impression you are dealing with a loan by loan here, which is inconsistent with the overall presentation which says on the first slide that the expected credit losses are not individually identifiable.
Yeah.
So I think this overall description talks about a portfolio. Bucket 2 is still a portfolio approach. It's a class of customers for which there is increasing. if we say the borrower on the risk, then we are at the loan level. So I think we should say the portfolio of borrowers, of that class of borrowers.
And moreover, it should probably also say an expected deterioration of financial.
One thing to think about, too, is, as Jana mentioned at the beginning, we're thinking about it from a commercial loan perspective. There's a difference between the identifying a loss and identifying the performance and the riskiness of a particular credit, okay? So I think when you look at it from the relative credit risk model where it says that, you may look at the loans individually every year, and a lot of commercial banks do that, and they risk rate them 1 through 5, 1 through 8, whatever it may be, but that doesn't mean they, at that point in time, set up a reserve for that. The reserve then would come into play as a separate exercise where they would say, okay, all loans that I've graded as a 1 would have, let's say, a loan loss rate, historical loan loss rate of, 0.25%, for example. So there, it was set up that way specifically to differentiate those two things and not necessarily combine them.
This is where I'm confused. Your explanation doesn't help me, because I thought that if you are looking at the loans individually, then you would transfer to bucket 3 or not, depending on your assessment. Yeah. Whereas I think here, because it's a macroeconomic, it's a macroeconomic event that is triggering classification in bucket 2 or transfer to bucket 2, then it has to be looked overall at the population, which might be affected by this event, macroeconomic, not micro. Oh, sorry, is it macro? It's non-macro, sorry, but it's not it is not micro. I think the problem with the difficulty in this model is to differentiate between a macroeconomic factor and a non-macroeconomic, which could be micro or something in between. If it is micro, clearly you are in bucket 3, because you do the assessment loan by loan. Bucket 2 is just in between. And I know that we try
to clarify.
I haven't discussed this with the team, Mr. Lippin, if you disagree, but I think further to Kevin's point, the first page, the event-based approach, was one way of articulating it, and it's consistent with what we were discussing at the last board meeting, where we made this distinction about individual loans, portfolio analysis, sort of while things were going well, that became an individual analysis as you got toward bucket 3. I think if we went with an approach that was based on credit risk management systems, if credit risk management systems are actually monitoring things on an individual loan basis, we might follow that with the absolute or the relative approach, because, as Kevin said, they may actually be looking at the credit risk of individual loans and reassessing the credit risk of the loans. So it may actually help us have a more granular analysis. So it may actually, because of the different model, it might actually change slightly the way we were talking about it at the last meeting.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Pat?
Thank you. I have a number of observations and suggestions for the staff. The first is, I believe the credit risk management approach is the preferable way to proceed with respect to this model. But I would propose the staff to consider a hybrid model, because I don't think the approach of either an absolute or a relative risk assessment is really mutually exclusive. I think at the point in time that you assign your classification to a given bucket, you're making an absolute assessment as to what you believe, presumably, either the expected loss is going to be over a certain period of time or over the life of the instrument, depending on which side of that coin or issue you come down on. But the initial assignment deals with coming up with what you think is the absolute credit risk. The market is far more concerned about relative credit risk. This is where it makes its money. On transition, okay? It wasn't a day that I spent in the 15 years, at Moody's, where people were calling up to principally ask, what's the rating? They wanted to know what's going to change the rating, right? That's how they make money. So my view is that a good model will employ elements of both to signal initial loss content by using different buckets, and a relative risk model to signal transition. Now, two areas that we haven't really gotten into here that are important, but you've teed them up, you've highlighted them, deal with how do you define expected loss by these three buckets? As Kevin knows, when we work together, most of the two, brand X and brand Y, have 21 rating categories. There's an infinite number of possibilities within the expected loss universe, right, of what a bond can yield. You only have 21 categories, though, to fit the expected loss amounts into. Here, we're condensing it to three categories. Okay, so one of the questions that we have to answer is how much expected loss is category one, bucket one? It might be the losses over 12 months. It might be the full lifetime. Bucket two and bucket three. So those are, that's one big question. The other one is how we define this transition matrix. What are the cues, as the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision has used that language, or the indicators, as you've suggested, to move from bucket one, from bucket one to bucket two to bucket three. So those are, in my mind, the two big areas. We can't have too much elasticity or too little elasticity, if you will, between these buckets, right? Because if you have very large elasticity, then nothing ever moves out of bucket two. You can have credit deterioration, and it never moves, right? To your point also in this document, we can't have an event of default as being a criterion for a movement. That has to be off the table here. Okay. Another recommendation I would make, which is consistent with where the Basel Committee is I would not refer to or use the word observable events. I would use terms like general or unknown trends and circumstances, conditions, or known trends and circumstances that are specific either at a portfolio level or an individual loan level. But I would avoid referring to any type of event because that conjures up something that has to occur before I take an action. The key here is also with a credit risk management system is I don't think that the judgment can be left entirely to management's assessment. So similar to what we've developed in the revenue recognition project and what we have in other areas that deal with fair value measurement, I would impose upon this system the need to maximize the use of observable inputs, not for measurement, but for recognition. So if the market is saying a year, 2 years running, that you're only going to get 15 or 20 cents on the dollar on a given sovereign risk, and you are not recognizing any loss content, or you're recognizing minimal loss content, I think that is contrary to really what we're trying to achieve in this model. So there has to be a combination of internal and external factors built into this overall credit risk management system. It just can't be management's view of, I think the economy is slowing down. So I think that's a critical element to weave into here. And that's more or less, the key thoughts that I wanted to leave with you.
I'm inclined to be supportive of the relative credit risk approach, but I want to understand more fully what the staff thinks the operational problems are. In the slides, it says it's operationally more complex in the absolute because the entity needs to compare and contrast credit quality with previous periods. But I'm wondering, under the absolute credit approach, how the entity knows which bucket the loan goes in unless it's comparing the credit quality of that loan this period to last period. Doesn't it need to move from one bucket to another? And how do you do that without comparing the credit quality? So I think it's along the lines of what Pat was saying, is that you have to sort of blend the two models somehow. The other thing I just wanted to clarify, in the absolute credit risk approach, it says new loans purchased at high credit risk would go straight to bucket two or bucket three with full lifetime effective losses. So if an entity's business is to make subprime loans, then every loan it makes will accrue the expected lifetime loss on day one. So in effect, it'd have day one losses. But another institution whose policy is to make prime loans would not have day one losses. Is my understanding correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct. If I can just come to this point where you ask about the differences on the absolute model and the relative model in respect to how do you allocate the loans and do you not need to track your deterioration or not, our understanding is that in credit risk management, they would just look at what is the level of credit risk today. And this is then how they would allocate this to the different buckets. They would not, so for a specific set of loans, so they would not track whether it deteriorated from a specific credit risk rating or not.
To answer your second question, you said that you'd have day one losses on the subprime, but you wouldn't have day one losses on the prime. You would have day one losses, if you want to call it day one losses, on both. It's just the magnitude of the loss. The subprime would have the full life expected loss. The prime would have either 12 months expected losses, 24 months. Yes. Yes. Yes.
So guess what's going to happen to the bucket two in the absolute model? It's going to be really empty, I think.
Depends on what the criteria are.
John. Oh, no, I think Mark Siegel was first. Mark, you go first.
Okay. I'm inclined to support the staff exploring the credit risk models generally. I agree with the assessment and the analysis that trying to find a principle to identify an event or you know, when to do it on an incurred or an event basis is going to be extremely difficult. I struggled with that myself. So I would definitely follow the credit risk management approaches. I have an initial leaning toward an absolute model, but I am going to be influenced as you analyze these further by thinking about things other than just commercial loans, right? Because right now I think you're saying, okay, well, this works for commercial loans. We've already identified, I'm not sure if it works for consumer. We haven't done a lot of analysis on what works best for debt securities. And what I don't want to do is create here's something for commercial, here's something for consumer, here's something for debt securities, and all of a sudden we've got three different models. So I feel like I definitely want to go down that path and explore it and then think more broadly about operationality through all of them. I think that, I'm intrigued about this idea of thinking about a hybrid, a blend of both approaches, but I would need to understand what the objective is that we're trying to get at. Because right now, the two approaches that we have are starkly contrasted with different objectives, I think. One is just a deterioration or migration model of what is the changes in credit risk. And another one is, here's what my assessment is today. And I think they're very, very different approaches. I think for those that are interested in what's going to be the trend, I think you actually get it in an absolute model too. Okay? You certainly will. And I think that would be important information to the extent that you know what your risk ratings are. And we've developed disclosures at the FASB that just went into place this year that actually follows this credit risk model. And so I think the conversation with users would be a lot easier because you do your recognition and measurement based on credit risk assessment, and you do your disclosures based on credit risk assessment, and it would flow generally nicely. And obviously, if we do it, we develop disclosures that would support it too. But you would also get in an absolute model information that would show you the trajectory of things that are changing over time. That I think gets at what Pat was saying. What's going to be happening in the future? And I think you'd get it under an absolute model as well.
Larry, you.
Yeah, I just wanted.
What you just said,
John. Let me do this work, okay?
Okay. The only thing that I don't understand with what you said, Mark, was because you brought in the current disclosure or the new disclosures that we put in effect this year, but those disclosures don't require companies to track the evolution. I mean, they are point-in-time assessments of credit quality, which I thought was more consistent with the absolute.
That's where my leaning was.
Okay, fine. Then I misunderstood.
Paul? Thank you. I have I lean toward the credit risk approach, but I've got a couple of questions. First one, when you describe that approach and when we're talking about it, sometimes we throw the word management in there and sometimes we don't. I can understand assessing impairment based on a loan's credit risk and a change in credit risk and the absolute, although I lean toward the absolute. But what does management have to do with it? I got nervous when I saw that word, that we're building another business model approach. And to me, what we're trying to do is assure that we've got an allowance that appropriately reflects the value of that instrument, or to write it down to the impairment of the instrument. And I'm not sure what management has to do with it. So maybe that's my first question. The second one is fairly small. The paper, and I think here as well, exclude loans in default completely. They don't go in, and I'm wondering what happens to those. They don't seem to be in bucket 1, 2, or 3. To me, where does it say that? What you say, I read in paper 7A, it says loans in default are excluded from bucket 3.
Just from the discussion.
Maybe I misread it.
Because it's obvious.
We just want to exclude it from the discussion. Because we made a different decision on those.
Okay, then I withdraw my question there. But they're in bucket 3.
Bucket 3, yeah.
Good. Then what about, to what extent is this manipulable by management policy?
They're all good guys.
I've sit next to you too long, John. It's rubbing off.
John.
Sorry, there was a question called.
There was a direct question. Yes, please answer the question, if you can.
I did. I agreed with him.
Okay. To Paul's question, I think we mean credit risk systems, really.
As opposed to the market.
Yeah, as opposed to what they're doing from a business perspective, the management per se. It's the systems we want to use that are already in place.
But Paul's asking, are those systems just different entities?
I was answering his first question. I'm not going to answer that question. John, you can answer that one.
John.
The credit risk approach, it sounds like it's something that ought to be explored. I wouldn't want to ignore events, though. I mean, event happens, it's obvious there's a loss. It would just seem to me that I don't want to ignore it. So hopefully it's not going to do that. On the question of absolute and relative, I'm not sure I understand it enough. Pat said, let's merge them somehow. I'm not sure that would work. It seemed to me, Kevin's comment, clearly you have the same instrument. You bought it at different times. It's got the same risk. It ought to be thought of in the same way in terms of the amount of risk. But I don't think having put everything in bucket 2 of this particular thing, that would necessarily tell me that I've got a loss on, or I'll say it a different way, that the reserves on each would be the same. And so while you talk about a tracking problem for the relative thing, because you got to know when it deteriorates, it seems to me you have a tracking on the absolute. So here's my example. I buy something at 100 at $1 or $1 per 100. And at the end of so many periods, the thing is worth, instead of 100, it's worth 70. And now I buy another one of those, and I buy it for 50. Do I adjust the 70 that I thought was my expected loss to fair value? And people would say, no, the fair value's got the liquidity piece in there. We shouldn't be doing that. But if I don't do that, I have different numbers. Alternatively, suppose I wrote it down, the first one, to 70, and now I bought the new one at 80. does that mean I ought to write the new one down to 70? And that doesn't seem to make sense either when the fair value said it was at 80. So I like the idea that I'm thinking of the risk the same way, but I don't think that necessarily tells me that my reserves are going to be the same in terms of the notional amount. I also, when I think of recognizing a loss, I think of it on the basis of changing expectations. I bought the thing, in my example, at 500, discount of 50% on the notional amount. I didn't buy it with the idea I was going to have more loss. But subsequent factors or changes in the environment may say I do. So it's that change that would tell me to recognize some loss. But so I don't have an answer on either. I see problems with, I understand the problems with both. But the way I think of it, the loss ought to be recognized when something bad happens, not just because I bought something.
Not because of? What did you say last time?
Yeah. Not just because I bought something. And it's a risky asset that I bought.
Daryl, did you? Or PK?
Yeah, very quickly. For me, whether it is a credit risk approach or event-based approach, really is semantics for me. The reason I say that is that any management, robust management system, which has the credit risk approach which has been developed, takes into account the events that are happening around it. So the methodology for your going back to Kevin's 1 to 5 or 1 to 8, whatever is that, is based on certain events that they see, trends and all that. So I think I agree that having just an event-based means you're removing the management thing, and it's been put to us to develop those events so well that they recognize it and they're devoid of their own judgment. And that I don't think is the right way to do it. But I'm hoping there will be a language when we develop the credit risk that management is not ignorant of the events that are happening around its around its economy or it's around its loans. We need to incorporate the event base somehow, or we expect the management to incorporate events around that into the system. In terms of the comment that Mark Siegel made, the objective of absolute credit risk approach and a relative risk approach is different for him. I didn't get that objective to be that starkly different, to me, honestly. Maybe I'm not understanding it well enough to say there are different objectives altogether. One is absolutely, if I buy A-rated, or if I give a loan to Kevin, which is ranked one being good, and if it moves to 3 because Kevin started defaulting 3 months later, how does that change between absolute credit and relative credit risk? It should not matter, right? So the objective is the same.
Well, you've got to add in other loans that you're buying in intervening periods.
The portfolio, let's think about the portfolio. Then it, of course, there's a little bit of tracking, for me, the objective is not that starkly different between the two. I just wanted to mention that, although I like Mark very well. I think on balance for me, any model you take needs to take into events around you into consideration. So, okay.
Can I just ask there, do you mean that when you consider the credit risk, that all events and all information, all circumstances that you see, whether it's internal or if it's external information, should be incorporated? Or do you mean that this model should differentiate what types of events puts a loan into bucket 1 or what types of events puts you in bucket 2? Because the idea of the credit risk management model is, of course, you're always going to consider all relevant information, i.e. all events that are happening or all indicators that you see that might indicate that there's a heightened credit risk. So I just would like to clarify
understanding. The latter one, I'm saying that, you know, you need to take into consideration how do you, if I'm auditing the company, I say, how do you even put this in category 1? What is your criteria for that? And I will ask you, hey, certain things happen to this. Why would you put it in this? That's all I'm trying to say.
Okay. Hal?
I've thought obviously long and hard about this the last 20 or 30 years, and one of the comments I've made, remember talking to a journal reporter a decade ago in the last credit cycle crisis, and I said when it comes to investing, investors are largely flying blind when it comes to credit risk. We have no idea. And it's reflected in stock prices. It has been for at least the last 20 or 30 years. So when I read through all this, I was initially very attracted to 2A, you know, the absolute, understood the mechanics of that, started to gravitate, and I'll blame this on Leslie, I started to gravitate toward a 2B and said, you know, relative is important. And then I think Pat summed it up very nicely. It's a hybrid. We need both pieces of information. So, you know, it'd be nice to stop there and say, I agree with Pat and Mark, but I can't do that. On the flight over, I sketched out my ideal investor world as to, and this is a matrix, is exactly what I want. And I, what's that? Well, I'll share it verbally. You'll never be able to read my handwriting. But if you conceptually agree, we can, maybe the staff can work on this a little bit more. We have. As long as he does the PowerPoint presentations, we're in good shape. So, what I thought about was, okay, yeah, we are getting credit information in the U.S. It's a good start, but it leaves me hanging on a lot of issues. So, what is it that I want? I know where I was in credit on an absolute basis last quarter. I know where I am this quarter. What happened in between? Well, clearly there were some additions. There were new loans. There were drawdowns on loans. There were purchases of loans. There were payments. There were charge-offs. There were other types of reductions on loans. There are a lot of elements here. Most important to me, in addition to that, all these things are important, but what's most important to me is this transition or migration into and out of various ratings categories. So I set up a spreadsheet that said basically by rating category and by line of business, Daryl and I were talking about this, by line of business or significant segment of business, what do I want? I want my starting point, I want my changes, both ins and outs, and I want my migration between rating categories. That will then give me where's my ending point. So it's absolute in its body. It's built off of an absolute system, but it captures the 2B component of this by giving me the migration. And I thought, do I want migration by net or do I want it by gross? And I thought gross in this particular situation because it would show me items going in, dollars going into each rating category, items dropping out of rating categories and moving to others. So that gives me migration. You can then take this matrix and then take it to the next level. Say, what are my expected losses over the next year for each of these rating categories? So you can give me expected percentages or however you want to articulate that, both at the last quarter and the current quarter, and then you drive some narrative about why did your loss expectation change? You then move over to your loan loss reserve, which would be an extension of this matrix, and you could have, based on whether we want it 12-month, 24-month, or expected life, have out in the far right-hand columns, how did all this information translate into, by rating category, whether it fell into the 24-month bucket or the expected life bucket. Then that adds up to your loan loss reserve. So you have the complete picture, you have absolute, you have transition, and you have the linkage between all these components and your ultimate loan loss reserve, and you can see changes in those. So then the issue becomes buckets. How do I take, and Daryl and I were talking about this, started to steal some of maybe what you were going to say. You know, Daryl gave me an example this morning. I said, yeah, our sovereign debt was rated maybe 1 through 14 on a 100-point category, 100-point score, correct? But some of your consumer was rated 1 through 10, or excuse me, 1 through 100. We've talked about 7 categories, 8 categories, 9 categories. Everybody's got a different different rating categories. So what we need to create is some type of universal joint that captures or couples between an existing absolute rating category and what investors are looking for, that comparability issue. So we've talked about a bunch of different ideas. The one I jotted down was much more about this is kind of picking up on something Leslie said at our ed session. She had used a more likely than not type of to get you into another bucket. So what I wrote down was, to be in bucket one, it'd be more likely than not that the loans, groups of loans or vintages, as I'd prefer to think about them, will perform in a manner consistent with the original expectations and pricing of that loan or group of loans. And if you start with that premise, whether I am doing a AAA rated credit and I price for that, or I'm doing a consumer credit that I priced for relatively, let's say, 10 and 20% default rate, but I've priced it at 16 or 20%, regardless, that's my expectation. That goes into a bucket one. Now, where I rate those in my internal system, I don't really care. Now, because I'm going to translate that to that maybe a rating 5, maybe a rating 1, maybe a rating 6. But it still goes into rating bucket one because my expectation was consistent with the pricing and losses and everything else. To move from a bucket one to a bucket two, I then have to go, it's no longer more likely than not that this will perform under my expectations. And you can debate, again, what's more likely than not, as we did in the last session on leases. And then the question becomes, if you want to keep a two bucket, excuse me, if you want to go from two buckets to three, then how do you go transition to the third bucket? Well, the more likely than not becomes, it's probable that it will not perform, or highly likely that it will not perform under my initial expectations. Yeah. And I think the three buckets could provide some useful information. So,
more likely than not,
will you create an effect from one to two? Well, I don't know the answer to that, but what I'm trying to do in the table that I laid out was, if I have, I've used an eight rating bucket or eight rating categories in some examples before. Let's say that my definition of buckets holds true in my first five rating categories all fall into bucket one. Okay, and I could envision where parts of six could fall into bucket one. But I draw a subtotal there. Here's my bucket one. And if I, over here on my right-hand side, this is where the loss expectations related to ratings comes in. If I see a migration, but I don't see an increase in loss expectancy between, I start to question that. So what I'm hoping would happen is that as you go from rating one to three, or two to three to four to five, my loss expectations are starting to ramp up. And, you know, Pat mentioned Moody's before. If you look at their universe or an S&P universe of default rates based on AAA, AA, single A, and as you go down the rating cast, it starts very slow, and it's a hockey stick. It starts to really ramp up. I would expect to see something very, very similar in this. And if you get there, if you move through the rating categories, you'll be building up that loss content. And once you move from expected, or let's call it 24-month, to full expected, that jump or that cliff effect should start to minimize if you get to this more likely than not concept, because I think you'll really narrow that gap between, say, a rating five and then falling into bucket two, going from bucket one to bucket two.
I have a question, just in terms of how you'd operationalize this.
Yeah.
If I understand the one to six where you'd be at bucket one, but suppose you bought at 20 cents on the dollar, mm-hmm. someone's sovereign debt today.
Yep.
Where would it be classified under your proposal, and to what extent would you have a loss?
Well, that's where I get into the expected, because if I bought, I'm not going to name the specific country, but if I buy it at 60 cents on the dollar, my expectations are very different than if I based it on 100 cents on the dollar.
No, I understand that.
So I may put it, if I were doing my rating system, I would probably put it in a category 4 or 5. I've got some risk there, but it's risk relative to the price that I paid. But I would put it in bucket one. Bucket one, because it's priced for my expectations.
Okay, so even if you bought it at 20 cents on the dollar, it's priced for your expectations.
I would put it in bucket one. Yeah.
It's more like 2B.
Yeah. But I may have, to take that more broadly, I may have in my market segments that says sovereign debt, okay, I may have a rating category that's different than, say, the consumer portfolio or the commercial portfolio. And those relationships and how you get into buckets one and two may be different than in the other segments of the portfolio.
And when we talked about purchasing of loans and things of that nature, it was more of a yield play than it was versus an allowance play. In other words, if you're going to purchase something that's impaired, I think we decided, the board decided, that you would accrete it up to your expected. But if you purchased a good loan, then you would accrete it up to contractual. So that's why I'm saying it's more of a yield play than it is an allowance play. So thinking about it the way Hale's thinking about it, he's not really thinking about purchasing things. He's thinking about originating things.
Well, I'm actually including purchase in this. That would be one of my additions to the category. I think it does work for both.
Could work for that.
Well, it works, but it's if we go with the decisions you already made, it's we're not going to set up allowances for those. We're gonna accrete them up to either contractual or expected.
Sure.
That was my point.
Which would drive where I rated it, probably.
Right. Sure.
Yeah. We still have many people who want to speak, sir.
Sorry.
Tom?
I thought the staff did a very effective job convincing me that an events-based approach is not workable. I can't identify in a multi-factor system that certain events are bucket one events and other ones are a bucket, change in bucket methodology. So that doesn't mean, however, and I think you are in a multi-factor approach, that events and circumstances won't be considered within the multi-factor approach in a credit risk management system. So I support moving forward on the credit risk management basis. Then thinking about the two different approaches under credit risk management bases, it's very tempting to want to do absolute because it's very simple. However, I don't understand the basis that we could ever explain to say that if I buy a lower credit risk instrument, that I get 100% of the expected losses on that one, but higher, lesser credit risk problems, I do a portion. I just don't understand the basis you would be able to justify that difference.
And what's the cut?
Well, you got a cut issue. So I move towards a relative risk management system because it is it's a change in multiple factors that cause a deterioration that wants you to treat it differently. And it is a hybrid system no matter what you do. Because if you put everything in bucket one to start, which is the only difference between the two systems is whether you put things in all three buckets to start or just one bucket. Because after that, you're going to be looking at actual circumstances as to how you come up with amounts.
It's the difference between ordinal and
cardinal time right here. I must say that I had a couple of comments, and they come very close to Tom's intervention. But first of all, impairment is an area, whatever we do, it's going to remain highly judgmental and highly vulnerable to earnings management. And it has always been so. The current circumstances around certain sovereign debt are a prime example of massive earnings management, no matter how much we wanted to prevent it at IAS 39. So I think we cannot get it perfect. The only thing we can do is to make abuse as difficult as possible. And I think the staff indeed did a very convincing job explaining that the events-based approach is not going to work because in the end it is a holistic judgmental judgment. But I think around the table I hear also we do need to have some objective cues or indicators or whatever so that they can go around it too easily. If you look at the present situation around Greek debt, if you just look at the impairment triggers in IAS 39, I could only find one, which is that the country is in serious financial difficulties, which is apparently still disputed by some, but that rather seems to be the case. So I think we've got a lot of work there, and I heard a lot of good comments around the table. And then absolute versus relative. There are apparently banks that are telling us that they don't have systems in place to track deterioration of credit. I mean, if that is truly the case, then I understand the current predicament of banks very well, but it is hard to believe this is the essence of banking. So they should be able to do something like that, and indeed a lot of banks have told us that, although it is maybe cumbersome, that they can do it.
And I agree very much with Tom. It is very counterintuitive that you would make a loan in a certain category, which is from the beginning is treated very differently, even though you have priced in the higher risk than a loan in a low risk category. So I think the relative model, if you would start with an absolute model, I'm sure it would converge into a relative model, because the bucket two is going to be nearly empty. Who's going to put? They'll start saying, "Yeah, my credit cards risk management system is so perfect. I have very low risks there," and they'll put it in bucket one. So I don't think it's going to work. So I completely concur with Tom's analysis. Amaru. Stephen, you after. Well, Stephen was first, I think. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'll go first. For the reasons that others have given, I would rule out the absolute approach, and I think several have commented upon that. In terms of the event-driven and the relative, I think somebody said that maybe there isn't that much of a difference, and I would agree. I think there is a lot of similarity there, because the reasons credit deteriorates is because of events and circumstances and things that change. And I'm not sure that these are two entirely different approaches. I think one could make the event-based approach work. People are used to that type of approach, and one can widen the net and include macroeconomic factors and deterioration in credit quality as being events. Perhaps we could call them indicators or find some other word. But I think when you move down that path, you get closer and closer to a relative approach anyway. In a sense, exactly how we do it, I think, does depend upon how we measure bucket one. Because if bucket one itself is a deterioration notion, then there is less pressure on deterioration in terms of moving to bucket two. If bucket one is a fixed 12 months, then I would be much more keen on getting deterioration as the key to moving to bucket two. So I think there's an interaction with how we measure the losses in bucket one. But for me, the main thing at the moment is ruling out the absolute approach in terms of risk management.
Amaru.
Thank you. Well, in the interest of time, I will do my shortcut. First, acknowledge again the effort staff has put in this issue. I will, of course, support exploring the risk management, and I would very much agree with Steve ruling out the absolute approach. In real life, the relative is the one banks use it. We've heard consistently that banks do not have as a basic model, and I think you mentioned high leverage once maybe as an exception. They do not have generally the practice to provide loans to enter into agreements, and knowing that the very first day that they have to make provision for that loan. So in real life, the relative represents very much what is in place. I would just add one comment to the events, or we are calling events, but this can be indicators or guidance, I don't know, because we are mostly driving our discussion considering banks that are more sophisticated. And of course, and you mentioned that in paragraph 10 that you started to do some outreach, and I understand, we understand, due to the limited time, we are mainly, I guess, outreaching European banks and U.S. banks and probably the major, most significant banks at this time. But we have a large number of banks that are small and medium, so they are not that sophisticated in their risk management systems. Only the U.S., if I'm not wrong, we might have more than around 8,000 banks that are small, medium-sized regional banks that they might not have that sophistication to capture well what we intend if we are too much principles-based in this sense. And also, we do have, this is going to be applied for all IFRS applicants, not only banks. So it's important to provide them more, and auditors, more room. No, because you mentioned you started your statement. If I were to audit a company, so again, this is important. Yeah. But again, congratulate the staff and thank you. Most important that I'm quite happy to feel that we are reaching in this table a converged position in both boards to this very important topic. And operationality is yet more key for me in this model.
Amaru, let's not count our blessings yet. It's very dangerous. Daryl?
Yes.
And then Ian?
I'm in favor of moving forward with further exploration of a credit risk model. To me, the relative credit risk model makes good sense when we're talking about purchased loans, because the amount that you've in effect invested in that loan is based on your assessment at the time that you bought it, so it could be cents on the dollar. But to me, the absolute makes more sense in an originated loan sense, because if we go back to what Pat was talking about with subprime loans versus prime, regardless of how we price that, if we make a $1,000 loan to a prime customer and price that at 5%, and we make the same $100 loan to a subprime customer and price that at 20%, it's hard to say that on day one when we make that loan that we don't have more principal at risk with the subprime loan than we do the prime, regardless of how we priced it. So to me, I'm making a distinction in my mind between originated and purchased on the relative and absolute.
Yes, Stephen, Tom.
I don't see how we can differentiate between originated and purchased. I mean, the economics is the same. It's a loan. I don't see how we can have an impairment model that differs in those circumstances. I mean, what would you do in a business combination? And everything in this new subsidiary is a purchase loan. Does that go into a different model, and then you then as you originate new loans, you have a different impairment model for those?
And this, I suppose the subprime loan would have a higher allowance in bucket one. Right.
A loss rate.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Higher loss rate. So that's so we don't treat them equal. Tom, did you want to add something?
And that's the point I wanted to make. If we start with a relative credit risk management system and you put all nine, say there's nine categories, all in bucket one, I'm still believing that whatever methodology we use to measure bucket one, that the highest quality has a lower loss rate, going down linearly till the most risky will have a higher loss rate starting in bucket one. But the interesting challenge when thinking about the relative credit risk system to the absolute is, if I were to think about absolute and there were nine categories, and let's say it was reasonable to say the first five categories are bucket one, the next two are bucket two, the next two are bucket three. Right? Let's say that's what the regression is. Now I put all nine of those categories into bucket one. Does movement of items from category, now I'm all in bucket one, if I move now, go forward from bucket one to bucket two, I mean category one to category two, does that movement, that deterioration get me into bucket two?
No.
And that's the challenge that we have. That's the challenge we have in operationalizing this. And that goes back to, I want to raise one issue. The staff suggests that you move into bucket two based on deterioration and something called an increase in uncertainty about the ability to fully recover cash flows. That would say not all deteriorations, one to two gets you to bucket two. But I don't understand well what that second criterion
is. I would say it's one and the same thing.
Yeah, it seems like one and the same thing. So that's the challenge in making that work.
Tom, I think the example that you just gave is that we should not try to become too exact here, because we are not risk managers, and we are not going to come up with a perfect system, and the banks don't have perfect system. We should just make sure that they can circumvent these questions too easily. Ian.
Okay. Gotta push the button now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Hans. I think we're reaching a reasonable degree of consensus here, so I won't be too long. I'll just make a few points. I agree with, I think it was Tom and PK and Steve, I think EventSpace has been given a hard time, because I think when we read about it on page 2, you talk about observable events, observable conditions, information available, all that stuff's going to feed in. The difference is we're talking about using the internal credit categories and mapping them to buckets. But that's semantic, really. Absolute versus relative. It seems to me if you know the absolute at the beginning of the period and the absolute at the end of the period, you must know the movement between the two. But maybe I'm just I'm oversimplifying. All right. So there may be operational problems there. But
the role part that I suggest, you need to know the other elements.
Okay. But the thing that's so I'm in favour of looking at credit risk models, but the thing that swayed me towards the relative model was the treatment of new and purchased and originated loans, and I think they should go into bucket one.
Leslie.
I'll try and just be incremental here. I'm supportive of a credit risk-based approach, and even though it might be semantics, I think it's extremely important that we send a clear signal that the model that we're developing is based on expected losses, and therefore I would avoid the use of the word events, as has been suggested by others. I like some of the suggestions that have come in from constituents, including words like cues and indicators, because it's a much more sensitive threshold that we're talking about that might signal a change in the accounting. I would be leaning toward more of a relative approach in terms of communicating this model, primarily because I think it translates better to a wider range of asset classes. I can't imagine a consumer company looking at its trade receivables and thinking about credit ratings for them. Whereas I think if we start talking about deterioration or changes in collectability, I think they do think about it that way, even if it's in terms of delinquency or other sort of more common ways of looking at loan losses in those types of situations. I think it's important under any approach that we pursue that we start communicating more clearly that we are talking about application at a disaggregated level, so that similar asset classes are being evaluated discreetly. And I know it's just been shorthand we've been using about these buckets, but it sort of sends the signal that you're lumping unlike things together and conducting this analysis, and I do not think that's what we've meant, and I think we need to be clearer about it. In that way, it's easier to talk about loss rates for riskier credits in bucket one, having higher allowances attracting to them, which I think does take some of the tension off of this cliff effect. If you're buying something at 60 cents on the dollar and putting it in bucket one, it will presumably have a very high loss rate associated with it, and then with very sensitive cues, it may move quickly into bucket two. I like a lot of what Hal said, and I admit that he repeated back some of the things that I had said, but but you rephrased it. You rephrased it.
Can we have some evidence for that?
you rephrased it in a better way. And I, what I particularly like that you said today was that to the extent that you see a deterioration more significant than what you had anticipated, that would be a trigger to start moving into bucket two. And I think that's the type of sensitive cue we're looking for that would justify moving away from the loss that you anticipated and therefore priced in to a different, more significant measure of losses. Hans said that anything we do here is going to be highly subjective. That's my positive way of phrasing what you said. And I completely agree with that. However, I think that the type of disclosure that Hal is talking about will bring the discipline that's necessary in terms of transparency. Because if there's a divergence between what the market is saying is happening to these credits and they're a very transparent presentation of the way the entity is viewing it, at a minimum it starts the dialogue for investors, but as well as for the regulators and others who are very keenly interested in looking at the adequacy and valuation of these loans.
Okay, well, I think we are ready to come to conclusions.
And I suppose the first question that we need to answer is, do we prefer a credit risk model in combination with, I think it's fair to say, a clear list of possible cues and triggers, indicators, which gives sufficient guidance to the market? I didn't think I heard anybody in favor of an events-based approach, so can we take this as the first conclusion? I think we have reached that unanimously. And then the second question would be whether we prefer an absolute model or a relative credit risk model. And, yes?
Can I make a clarification on the events? It seems to me that clearly when I've moved, say, from 2 and going from 2 to 3, I think that's going to be more of an event than anything else. And so I don't think we're just getting rid of events.
No,
okay.
I mean, like a credit crisis might be a very clear event and a possible cue, I would say.
I can see in bucket one, you're looking at the overall credit piece. But as you move down, you bring them into consideration. Okay, I just don't want to lose that.
Can I make a clarification?
Sure. There's been a discussion around the table, or, you know, with respect to this question you're about to pose, absolute versus relative, and I had suggested a hybrid. Let me clarify why. I think Leslie's closing comments captures it. There's two different ways you can signal the absolute credit risk on the point in time you purchase or the point in time you originate. You can do it with a higher or lower carrying amount, allowance, which could still all be in bucket one. Or you could signal it by saying that loans with higher carrying amounts, or I should say lower carrying amounts or higher allowances, should be in buckets two or buckets three. Okay, it's just a different convention. So as long as there's disclosure within this bucket one or bucket two of the relative distribution of expected losses, I'm fine with putting everything in bucket one, okay, day one, whether you originate or purchase it. But I need to know that the expected loss content on a subprime loan is different than a prime loan or a leveraged loan or some other loan. And so if you're going to do that via disclosure, I'm fine with that.
There are different portfolios to start with.
But it doesn't matter. You could still have within the same portfolio if subprime loans have a distribution, okay, or within residential loans, you know, that aren't subprime, or corporate loans. So the point I'm making here is there's two different ways you can signal it. Just as long as there's adequate disclosure to show that distribution of expected loss, I think is the critical point. Well, that's the absolute point that people are interested in.
I'm glad that you mentioned it, because I think from the discussion it was also clear that disclosure is very essential in either approach, but especially in the approach that I think we have a majority for.
Well, it's a communication problem that we're having. Some people might read.
Oh. let me just go. Yeah.
There's a communication problem we might be having, because some people might read us saying bucket one means all the loans in that bucket are homogeneous or will be treated the same. You know, it's category one, and there's different portfolios of loans within that category that are accounted for that way. So it's different ways of measuring the allowance.
We didn't discuss the degree of the allowance. It's different.
Okay. So I would just... Yes, Philippe?
Last question on the indicators of transfer from bucket one to bucket two. We talked about events, but also indicators of changes in economic conditions with potential significant impact on the ability to collect cash flows, which is not what the paper is suggesting. Paper paragraph 45A suggested that the trigger is a deterioration in financial performance of the borrower, which is to me too late. We don't have to wait for this deterioration in financial performance to be observed.
Yes, sorry. These principles are just a general direction, and what we mean is like to assess
whether there is an actual or an anticipated deterioration. So I think that's, sorry, we need to work on the wording.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, because for me it was just, it was event-driven. It was not indicator-driven.
Okay, no, that's a very good clarification. Okay, so I would ask who is in support for the relative model.
ISB.
FASB.
I'm supportive of a hybrid, so I didn't know which way to vote on that.
Just give us a hybrid vote and help.
Pat, you voted. But
the way you describe it is relative.
Yeah, but how? Okay.
If the way I describe it is relative, I'm fine.
I was supportive of what you said and what Pat said, and I thought you were promoting the relative objective that needs to be worked out.
Okay. If that's the case, then I'm all for relative.
Do you agree with that?
I guess the clarification I would ask for is, it seems to me, the significant difference between absolute and relative is that absolute would require full lifetime loss to be recognized on anything that was initially classified in bucket two. With that clarification, does anybody support that? Right? Is it?
And I agree that's not.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe we don't fuss too much about what we call it, but.
Okay. I think we have agreement.
With that clarification, count me in.
Okay, good enough.
But just to confirm what you want the staff to do going forward, because the staff recommendation was actually, I think, that we wanted to leave absolute and credit. I'm looking to Kevin here. Absolute and relative potentially open so that we could explore both of it further. But is the board saying you want us to explore relative, make sure it's operational?
Yeah. Well, it must be our lucky day, but we still have
the new chairman.
Okay, then I think we can continue on with paper 7D, which might be a little bit more difficult.
Yes, thank you.
Which is the measurement of bucket 1.
I guess I was hoping this would be a little more simple.
Okay, Sarah, well, you know, go for it.
Okay, so moving on to agenda paper 7B or FASB memo 101. As we just discussed, the boards agreed in June to develop a three-bucket approach. At that meeting, the boards agreed that the allowance balance in buckets 2 and 3 would be based on remaining lifetime expected losses. So this paper and this discussion is only going to focus on the calculation of the allowance for the loans in bucket 1. At the June meeting, the boards directed us to further develop alternative C, which was recognizing an impairment allowance equal to 12 months' worth of expected losses based on initial expectations, plus the full amount of any changes in expected credit losses. Paragraphs 7 to 11 of this paper describe that alternative as it was presented in the board paper of the June meeting. Again, during that meeting, you were very clear that the approach for measuring bucket 1 should be operational, so you directed us to perform outreach to identify ways to operationalize alternative C if possible. Paragraphs 12 through 15 discuss the feedback that we received from that outreach. A consistent message was that alternative C was operationally difficult and would require the tracking of origination data, which we have heard time and again is very difficult for entities to maintain. Many constituents, including members of the EAP, provided their view that if a credit migration model was followed and assets were transferred into bucket 2 or 3 on a timely basis when credit deterioration became apparent and sooner than envisioned for a bad book in the supplementary document, then the pressure on the allowance balance of the financial assets in Bucket 1 may be somewhat relieved. In other words, the calculation of Bucket 1, in their minds, should be as operationally simple as possible because the benefits in terms of any real impact on the magnitude of allowance balances would be outweighed by the additional costs and complications of a more complex approach. This highlights the importance of the interaction between the criteria that causes transfers between buckets and the allowance calculation in bucket one. So using all that feedback, the staff have identified four possible methods for calculating the allowance balance in bucket one. There was essentially no support for the time proportional approach in the outreach, so it's not addressed in this paper. The first two methods, A and B, are not simplifications of alternative C from the June meeting. Rather, they are really more in line with alternative A from that meeting, and they are the most operationally simplest, if that's correct grammar. The difference between the approaches is whether you use 12 or 24 months' worth of expected losses as the allowance balance. Both of these methods could use a loss rate to determine the losses expected to occur, and later in the paper, we present a discussion of the terms annual and annualized loss rate. To reiterate, the biggest advantage of these methods, A and B, is the operational simplicity compared to previous proposals. Some support a 12-month calculation because such calculations are already performed for annual budgeting processes and for regulatory purposes for sophisticated banks under the Basel requirements. Some support a 24-month calculation because they desire a bigger allowance balance in bucket one to alleviate the cliff effect that results by a transfer to bucket two with a full life loss. The challenges with these two methods is that they create rules or bright lines based on an arbitrary time period. There is a cliff effect that results by transferring loans from a less than life loss to a life loss in bucket two. And the loss rate would have to be recalculated each period, taking into account the effect of those transfers from bucket one to bucket two, which may be difficult to do for the loans remaining in bucket one. Historical information may not exist for those loans remaining in bucket one alone, but rather the historical information exists for the loans remaining in bucket one and those transferred to bucket two. So the loss rate on bucket one may include some expectation for losses on loans that have actually been moved to bucket two and for which a full life loss has been recognized. That's more fully described in paragraph 31 of the paper. Before I discuss methods C and D, I'll comment on the annual versus annualized loss rate discussion in paragraphs 68 to 78. The staff believes that the term annual loss rate may be being used inconsistently around the table and believes a common understanding should be established. The same sort of discussion is also warranted if the boards were to go to a 24-month rate or a twice-annual rate, but I'm just going to use the term annual rate for this discussion. Many of the methods described above would permit the use of an annual loss rate to capture 12 months' worth of losses. There are at least two ways to think about a 12-month loss rate, in each case starting with all available information, so historical default information and adjusting for current information, including forward-looking information. An entity could use an annual rate, which would be the losses expected to arise on the portfolio of assets in the next 12 months, or the other way to think about it would be an annualized rate, which would be the remaining lifetime expected losses divided by the life. For example, if an entity expected to lose 10% over a five-year remaining life, then the annualized rate is 2%. The distinction is important because of skewed loss patterns. An entity may expect to lose the 10% over a five-year life, but may expect that it's going to lose 6% in the next year. The annual rate would be that 6%, whereas the annualized rate would be 2%. There are challenges and advantages associated with both an annual and an annualized rate, and those are detailed in the paper. Now back to methods C and D in paragraphs 46 to 66. These are two possible methods that were designed with the intention of simplifying alternative C from the June meeting. Method C would record an allowance balance in bucket one as the higher of 12 months' worth of losses and the difference in the current loss rate and the average rolling rate multiplied by the balance of loans in bucket one and the remaining average life of the loans in bucket one. So as the current rate is updated each period, you will ensure that the allowance balance will include the effect of any change from the previous average rate over the remaining life of the loans. For example, if the current annual loss rate is 3% and the average loss rate is 2.5%, the difference is that 0.5%. That 0.5% is applied to the balance of the loans over the remaining life of those loans. Method D would recognize an allowance balance that represents the remaining lifetime losses of loans currently in bucket one that are expected to move to buckets two or three in the next 12 months plus the effects of any deterioration in the credit quality of loans expected to remain with Bucket 1 after the next 12 months. The advantage of these two methods is that they are more responsive to the effect of lifetime changes in expected losses than methods A and B. However, these methods are more complicated than either methods A or B, although initial feedback that we received was that entities would be able to calculate the inputs necessary for method C. I'll just make a quick comment on paragraph 67. All of these methods, A, B, C, and D, will have a day one loss or initial period effect if the analysis is done at the individual loan level or for purchased for acquisition scenarios. The staff recommendation is in paragraph 79 to 85. The staff and boards have been working to develop a model that can be applied consistently to open and closed portfolios, as well as to single instruments and the model that is operational. As a result, and for other reasons outlined in the paper, the staff has recommended that only methods A and B, the 12 or 24-month approach, be pursued further. And for the reasons of operational simplicity, the staff also recommends that the methods refer to an annual loss rate, not the annualized loss rate, because that annualized loss rate starts with the lifetime expected losses and divides by the remaining life. The questions to the boards are listed after paragraph 85, and I'll turn it over.
Well, as you can see in the paper, the staff were very disobedient because they came up with a suggestion that we had asked them not to pursue. They came back to a variant that we had disregarded in the previous meeting. But I suppose that goes to show how difficult it is to operationalize the variants that we had asked them to pursue. So having said that, I would open the floor for comments and questions. PK?
I reserve the right to come twice.
Well, I'm not going to make any comments. Okay.
I said I reserve the right to come back one more time. But let me ask a question. In your outreach of your EAP, you mentioned that you had done some outreach to EAP. I'm expecting those people include sophisticated and not-so-sophisticated banks, which is, like Amaro correctly said, this is not just for the banks, but let us stick to financial institutions for a time being. Would they all have kind of given a conclusion to you that, you know, operationally simple, we will ignore our sophistication, our internal processes, and stick to 12 months or 24 months to persuade the staff to come to that? And anybody raised alternative C, which is, I appreciate, is kind of close to SD, but not really SD. But is there unanimously they said, because that would influence me to some extent, because as you know, that I'm not in favor of A and B, but I'm more close to C. But having said that, I just want to understand, are we putting all banks in one bucket, all financial institutions in one bucket, and there's no sophistication between Bank of John Smith and PKS?
The reference to EAP was there wasn't a full EAP meeting put together. We met with some members of some EAP that were members of the EAP. They also provided us some feedback, and yes, I would say that they were unanimous in that as long as we get the transferring between buckets 1, 2, and 3 right, that the allowance balance and what we do for bucket 1 should be very simple, because the magnitude of those allowances is not going to be as significant, and so it shouldn't be complex, is what they were very unanimous on that. It needed to be as simple as possible.
Yeah, they felt that because if you're picking up significant deterioration through a transfer to bucket 2, that you shouldn't be so reliant on bucket 1 to pick up the effect of changes in deterioration, which is what really alternative C is all about. It's this responsiveness concept. So they didn't think that the incremental difference in the allowance balance would justify the extra operational complexity of alternative C. They also felt that for the TPA, the time proportional approach, even though they confirmed that they still believed it was operational, they didn't think that the incremental benefit justified the additional complexity of having a more complex approach in bucket 1.
Is there anything in your discussion that was kind of alluded in the paper?
It's been a week since I read the paper. the it kind of alludes that the time that a portfolio of loan or a segment of a portfolio of a loan would stick into bucket one for a too short period of time because it moves into two because the triggers are quicker to move into two. Is there any reason for that, or there is no discussion in that area?
I think if I know what parts of the paper that you're referring to, when we say that they would move quicker into bucket two, I think we're comparing that to what some of the interpretations were, for example, of the SD and when things would go from a good book to the bad book. I think we're also comparing it to when you would recognize an incurred loss today. So things would move quicker and you would recognize more of a loss than you would today based on the paper that we just talked about in the transfer of the assets.
Thank you. Daryl.
I think I was probably the noisiest supporter of alternative C at the last meeting. So, and I was pretty much felt that because I felt that the information would be available to the banks. They could actually put that information together to get something right under C. I think since then my position has changed, and I'm actually now supporting probably the A or B option. And I'm doing that primarily, firstly, because of the argument that Sue has mentioned, that the incremental number that's going to appear in the financials is not going to be that different, depending on. But I think just as importantly, I've been persuaded that the two alternatives that I've been thinking about in C, firstly, that banks be allowed to use whatever level of sophistication they've got, would give rise to a number which in no way would be comparable between banks, because each bank would come up with a completely judgmental, completely different method. The second way of doing it would be for us to suggest a formula, something like a TPA on steroids. The problem with that was that you'd end up with an answer that would produce something right a lot of the time, but that none of the banks would necessarily buy into, and that in each circumstance they'd be coming back and saying, well, their answer might be better or their answer might be worse. So in the end, I like the idea of then going with a very, very simple approach, one that can be very easily understood, but one that is still based on a number that contains an element of judgment, a loss rate that management can stand behind that they are accountable for. Because that accountability then becomes the final thing that, that sort of keeps them honest and keeps them on the road. So I think A and B, or A or B.
Larry.
Yeah, I was hoping just to point out, hopefully most people have excluded Method D from the alternatives that they're considering, but well, Method D is described in the paper as a simplification of Alternative C, and I find it very difficult to view Method D as a simplification whatsoever. I mean, first of all, it requires you to not only, you know, you still have to evaluate what loans transfer into buckets 2 and 3, but now you also have to evaluate what loans are going to transfer into buckets 2 and 3 over the next year, and I find that to be operationally practically impossible. And then you still have the credit deterioration on the remaining loans in bucket 1. So just to characterize Method D as a simplification, I think, is somewhat of an overstatement, and I would not consider it whatsoever.
Pat.
I can support, frankly, either of these two methods, A or B, 12 or 24 months. But the refinement that I'd like to introduce into this analysis here, particularly if we go with the 12-month approach, is an idea that was raised in paper 7A that nobody really discussed. It was, I guess, part of the overall relative risk analysis discussion, which is the use of watch lists. And I think it should be mandatory disclosure that watch lists be developed and disclosed by bucket. So if you've got stuff that you think could transition into bucket two, then I want to know about it, even though you didn't provide for it. If you got stuff that you think is going to transition to bucket three, I want to know about that too. I want to know what your internal thinking is about problem loans, potential problem loans.
The only.
And that's done today, by the way. Banks do that today, so we're not introducing anything new here. Hal can confirm that for you.
I think the only thing we should just clarify, and Kevin, you can add to this if you like, is for people listening. I think the term watch list means different things in different geographies. So to American banks, watch list often means a particular category of credit risk, the bucket two type.
What I'm saying is things that where you mean things more where likely than not, so maybe greater than
you're talking about watch list like a
rating agency. Transition from this bucket to that bucket.
Yeah, but I just want to clarify that. That's a sort of European perspective of watch list, but not an American.
Well, you know, it doesn't necessarily say that based on this definition.
Yeah.
I have a lot of sympathy for the approach, whether it is A and B. I think maybe there is not one single answer. It may depend on the class and category of loans, on the length of the loan. So I don't have a firm view. But I have a question on the intersection between the models, the model in bucket one measurement and bucket two. Because in model one, we talk about a loss rate, which is based on historical data, adjusted for current information, including forward-looking data. Right. So you take into account indicators, either current or forward-looking, that will increase your loss rate. But the same is used to move, to transfer from bucket one to bucket two. So is it about a degree of severity in those indicators that will either trigger within bucket one an increase in the allowance without a transfer to bucket two? And if it is more severe, then it triggers a migration to bucket two. I think there is a subtle point to explain here. How this expectation of increase in loss rates will keep you in bucket one or will trigger you migrating to bucket two.
Can the staff?
I think the point you're hitting on, I think, is to do with double counting, and it's something that we are conscious of that. We need to think about how we deal with that to make it clear that we're not using the same information in two different ways.
Stephen.
So you said earlier that bucket one should be simple. I think you used the phrase as the magnitude is small. I don't know whether that's true or not, and how big a bucket one allowance would be, whether it's 12 months, 24 months. But it seems to me that if it is small, particularly taking into account what Philippe has just said, why are we worried about this? And maybe we should just have zero, and we should have just an earlier transfer to bucket two, and that would capture the relative changes, and we'd be done with it. However, if it's more significant than that, and maybe it is, then I have problems with the 12 months and the 24 months for exactly the reason that we seem to reject the absolute approach just a few minutes ago. We didn't want the absolute approach because we said it's odd to originate a loan and then put it straight into bucket two and book an allowance when you originated the thing at market and at fair value. And now we're saying suddenly that we originate a loan, put it into bucket one, and we book an allowance, which seems to contradict what we were saying 10 minutes ago. Okay, it's 12 months or 24 months, which might be small for a loan of 10 years. What if these are two-year loans? What if these are consumer loans? We're booking most of the lifetime loss in exactly the same way that we decided we wouldn't do it 10 minutes ago. So I don't understand what we're doing here. So my question is it small or is it significant, this bucket one allowance?
I shouldn't have said small. I'll say that right now. But I don't know if it's significant either. What I meant to say was that the magnitude of the impact on the magnitude of the allowance balance is going to, the cost of coming up with a complicated method for bucket one is going to far outweigh the benefits of that impact on the magnitude of the allowance balance. Does that make sense?
Well, that's the judgment call, isn't it? I mean, I disagree.
That was the feedback that we got.
It's the incremental effect, I think, not the absolute amount. It's the incremental effect caused by doing this extra adjustment, whether or not that's significant or not. But I think that it's a fair point. We don't really know how big the numbers really are, which I think is one of the reasons why staff haven't really come down on a firm 12 or 24 months, because I think we really need to do a bit more work to understand. But you still wouldn't go with the 12 or 24.
Whether it's the 12 or the 24, my point about our prior discussion still holds. And obviously, the longer it is, the more it holds, but it holds whatever the time.
Thank you. Tom?
My support for relative versus absolute, what isn't the reason that you gave? my support for relative versus absolute is I cannot come up with a concept that even though I'm recognizing this in the first period, why for certain classes of loans I do the life, and certain classes of loans I do less than the life. So it isn't about materiality, it's about what is the driving concept for the difference between lifetime and 12 or 24, if that's where we're at. And I can't come up with that. I can come up with reasons to move to lifetime if what it is based on deterioration. Something is expected deterioration, not actual, but expected deterioration. Something has happened to say it's changed, so I will start in bucket one with some sort of minimum expectation that I will put on steroids once I have a deterioration expectation. So it wasn't quite the same, and I want to make that clear. I support the staff's recommendations, both of them. I think annual loss rate is far better than annualized. We know that we've seen that loss emergence patterns are front-loaded, that once you start paying off loans, you tend to continue to want to pay them off, so you don't have to give up all the collateral if there's collateral, despite the fact you paid off some. But loss emergence patterns seem to be front-loaded. So annual is far better than annualized. I have a stronger preference for 24 months, in part just because I'd like a little more, but I also think it has something to do with the cliff effect, that if we go from 12 to lifetime, you're going to have a lot more resistance for moving if the cliff effect's bigger at 12 than it is at 24. Now, so, but that's, I don't have a real strong preference, and I think that's why the staff raised that in their memo. And I think you're saying look at both 12 and 24 because there's countervailing factors to think about both 12. And the 24 has to be a 24-month annual rate, not annualized rate that you're talking about, too. Oh, the last thing I think we have to make clear, though, is if you're in bucket one and there's, say, five absolute credit grades in bucket one, and you don't move to bucket two when you're measuring this, but you move from level one to three, the rate goes up.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the intention.
Right.
Yeah.
Stephen, did you want to come back?
Yeah. Yes. The phrase, Tom, I would like a little more. So could you elaborate on how much more, and what is the conceptual basis for I'd like a little more?
I think we're going to be challenged in bucket one for however many different portfolios as to why we're recognizing an allowance before there's been evidence of deterioration. I believe that you could end up saying that in issuing loans, even though you don't have specific loans you think that are going to be bad, there is historical evidence that within a time period in the portfolio, there is going to be problems. And so I recognize a loss up front for that problem. And I go to 24 months just because 12 months is, you might not even get almost all the amount of the allowance might not be enough to cover what happens in the 12 months if you underestimate just slightly.
Many people, can I have a comeback?
Because many people, final comeback.
Many people have said that the allowance would be sufficient, and these words are banded around. And I think we've got to remind ourselves that we're standard setters setting standards for the use by capital markets for investors to make decisions, and we're not banking regulators. If I was a banking regulator, I'd have an entirely different view. It wouldn't be 12 months or 24 months of expected losses. It would be 24 months of stress case losses. Very different approach. But we're not banking regulators. And the 12 months, 24 months does produce a day one loss. And my question is, how is that useful information for users of financial statements when a loan has been originated at a market rate?
But to say that not to produce a day one loss is not
the aim of accounting either.
Sure, but we already have a day one loss because we have in IAS 39 at the moment the requirement that we should book these things at fair value. So if you originate a loan at greater than fair value, it's already written down. And in that situation, a day one loss is required, it's justified, it's perfectly correct. But if you originate a loan at a fair market rate, what is the information content in immediately writing that down for 12 months, 24 months, whatever the amount is? Banking regulator, absolutely. But standard setter, I just don't think we should be doing it.
Yeah, I suppose Stephen has a point there. And if the banks had sufficient capital to withstand a little bit of loss, then
yeah, I mean, I'd make it 6 months.
We might not have been having this conversation. Now, on the other hand, I share Tom's view that.
I mean, also, I'd like to pick up Tom on the cliff effect, because I know what you, I understand what you mean. It seems to me building one cliff, so the next cliff's not so bad, you know, and I'm not sure that's really justified either.
Yeah, and is.
Sorry.
Yeah. As long as we make sure that if it's moving within the first bucket, we increase the annual loss rate or the 24-month rate, when you move within that bucket, there's far less of that concern. But that's going to be a challenge to indicate the cues that will cause you to say that you have to increase the annual or 24-month loss rate within that bucket.
Hal. I'm not going to repeat everything that Tom said because I largely agree with everything that he has said in this issue. What I did do, though, in preparation for this meeting, I wanted to understand between methods A and B what would happen. So I did a little bit of research, went back and looked at all commercial banks in the U.S. from 1948 to into 2010 and applied method. I attempted to apply method A and B to the analysis, and I can poke holes in the exact form because I don't have a bucket one to really focus on, but I can make some assumptions. Bottom line here is that method A would have virtually no impact on U.S. banks, and I start with the belief that there has to be some change here. Reserves generally have been inadequate in the U.S. banking system. Method A, I believe, would have no impact, and I could actually even argue for a little bit lower reserve.
Can you elaborate why that would be the
case? Why? I'm sorry, why?
Why method 12 months would not have any effect
on? I went back and just looked at what the charge-offs were in the succeeding or the subsequent 12 months, and by and large, banks in the U.S., particularly from 1970 on, have had more than 12 months worth of charge-offs. Now, you've got to get in there and segregate between performing and non-performing. You've got to do some additional analysis. But my general belief is that banks already are meeting Method A in the U.S. And we've already, and I believe that I believe that U.S. banks are not generally over a cycle been adequately reserved. They've been boom and bust, right? So my question was, do I believe in Method A or Method B? Forgetting about all the theoretical, Method A will do very little for the analysis.
Ignoring the impact of buckets B.
I'm ignoring them, you're right, and I don't have a great
I understand that.
But I can go back and make some additional assumptions, and even with making those additional assumptions, I'm so far over the 12 months, even now, that even if I backed out the non-performers, I think I would have 12 months in there.
But how perhaps that might be the reason why the American banking system is in a little bit better shape than the European banking system.
We can sit there and debate that, but between methods A and B, A will do, I think, very little. B, I think, will actually increase the reserves. So I just want to put that on the table, and we can, you know, have the staff, I can share with them like my back-of-the-envelope analysis and dig into that a little bit more.
But sort of further to Hans' point, that's an American bank perspective. I think the answer would be quite
American
different outside
system.
The
U.S.
But Hal's point is we don't want to take a step backwards here.
Right.
Yeah,
that I understand.
You can see, this is one of the reasons why I prepare a response
if it's an outside system.
Correct.
Yeah.
But it wasn't done on just performing, so that's the problem.
Exactly. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
I don't have, that's what I said, I do not have a bucket one and two to really go to, and I can make some assumptions and further refine it, but even when I do that, I get back to A will have very little impact.
Daryl.
I agree to a lot with the things that Stephen was saying and the concerns that Stephen has about the one-year allowance. That said, I've come at this not saying that I believe that a one-year allowance is a correct amount in and of itself. What I'm saying is that everything that we've seen and heard up to now has given us reason to believe that even in the good book, there's inherently something in there that is a little bit bad. And we've gone through lots and lots of attempts here to find a methodology more and more complicated to estimate what we think that amount would be. I think my feeling is we've come to a point now where what makes sense is to go with the one-year estimate, not because it's the right number, but because the one-year number provides us with a very simple way to approximate something that's in there. In terms of the question mark of usefulness to the market, I think the fact that we would be looking to probably oblige management to give their best view of what they think is going to happen in the next 12 months, that viewpoint, that indicator that they're giving the market is very useful information because it's putting management on the line to say what they think is going to happen in the next 12 months and holding them accountable to it. So I think the information is useful from that perspective. I'm sort of inclined to say that I don't like the idea of 24 months because it feels to me like it's then too much on the basis of what I've just said. 12 months feels to me like the right number, but I also say it's what it feels like.
From Daryl to Daryl, or speak, and then I go to Wago.
I think it's a losing battle. Yeah, I fully agree with Daryl. I think anytime we want to select principles based on a number, we actually are making decision between worst or worser.
Mm-hmm.
And
not quite.
Be guided. And then the question to us is, how can we justify, we want to say the worst and the worst. And I fully agree with Simpra, and also Tolman's is consistent with our any worse and worst choice in revenue recognition, insurance, leasing, and others. And if we want to sell ones different from Tolman's, then we have to justify. And people will feel easily to say against us, and then use leasing and revenue others as examples. Why you make such a decision based on 12 months rather than 24 months? So I fully agree with Daryl.
Okay, Elke?
I think there's...
And then John.
I agree with Daryl. I think there's no principle behind using 12 or 24 months. There's perhaps one thing, so you could flip a coin, but there's one argument, if you're going for relatively short-term loans, then 12 months is probably more logical. Otherwise, you would say, why do I take 24 months on a 3-year loan and I take 24 months on a 20-year loan? That just doesn't make much sense. So 12 months is from a practical point. What is by far more important is that we get the transfer from bucket 1 to bucket 2, right, and that we get it transferred at a relatively reasonable early point in time and not at a point in time when you should already start to consider the transfer into bucket 3.
John.
Well, A or B, I could support. I lean toward A because I think of it more as an IBNR approach in which, even though you would say nothing's changed, they just made the loan, given the current state and given the inability to really predict what's in a big portfolio that's not good, 12 months sounds like a reasonable way to think about it. Now that said, it's arbitrary. I accept that. What's bothering me a little bit about the 12 months is we started out with a TPA, and
I thought we were pretty much done until we started having debates with the FASB, and you guys told us, and we agreed, 12 months or TPA wasn't enough. And that typically would have been more than 12 months. So, yeah, we can debate that any way you want, but it just seemed to me on an average. I'm not finished yet. But I think of the weighted average life of a portfolio typically being more than 2 years, I would get there. But that said, one of the things that a regulator said at a meeting I attended recently was that they would prefer more because they're concerned that we're not going to get bucket two correct. That the cliff effect, the resistance to moving in there, and the comment was, we really thought you got bucket two correct. We don't even need anything in bucket one. So I think the pressure is on bucket two. I would also say, when I think about arbitrary 12 months in bucket one versus 24, I could start out with the loans in bucket one that are in the really low risk 12 months. If it's really high risk, your horizon of uncertainty increases, as does the rate, as you pointed out, and I could see going for a longer period in the high risk stuff. But it's arbitrary no matter what you do. But to me, 12-24, at least, you can make that somewhat operational relative to methods C and D.
Okay, I think we...
If, for example, the boards went for a 12-month approach, would you proscribe or would it be proscribed in GAAP that you couldn't provide a dollar or a day more than 12 months so that, you know, down the road someone comes back and says, what you've done is created an incurred loss model? Is that the potential here?
You're saying there should be...
Now, what if somebody wanted to provide more than 12 months, if we choose 12 months?
Then they should move to bucket two, but they have to have a reason.
But would you allow them to? Yeah,
one foot out.
That's just a
question.
Why? Yeah.
Exactly.
Why would we allow them?
Exactly.
I don't think anybody's in those. It goes back to this question of how you define bucket one.
You know, if you have a wide range of expected loss possibilities in bucket one, then, you know, I could see this being possible. If you have a narrow range, then perhaps you're less concerned with it. It feeds into John's point about, you know, if you got bucket two correct, you don't have to really worry about bucket one. But, you know,
but if you get bucket one too big, you have a lot of potential for cookie jar.
I guess just to Pat's point, I agree with most of that has been said. And I guess Pat's point is exactly John's point. The bucket two is the issue. Because whenever we got the bucket two, the transfer from bucket one to bucket two correctly, this will be clearly a signal that the entity, I'm not calling the bank, but the entity is not following correctly the principle or to transfer from bucket one to bucket two. So I think, as John said, this is an arbitrary choice for the 12 months. We can rationalize on IBNR concept. And also, it wasn't mentioned, but I've learned with during the discussion that banks, they have systems in place to use 12 months because they have regulatory capital requirements over these. And we are not talking here about 100 loans. We are talking sometimes in millions of loans. So even if we require 24 months, banks will stay, at least in my knowledge, they will have to calculate for the 12, they will have to calculate for the 24. Depends on who is requiring the information for. So being an arbitrary, if you get the transfer from bucket 1 to bucket 2 correctly, I think at the end of the day, even the house analysis will be completely different because the impact on the bucket two is not captured. It's impossible to be captured in his analysis.
Bucket two
And he also, to perform an analysis that I found very interesting, his comments, you have to consider many other, and control many other factors in this, the economic cycle and the types of portfolios and everything.
The very fact that we have a bucket two is important, because if a bank has a completely empty bucket two, not very plausible. John, did you?
I have a question. Maybe it's for staff, maybe Daryl, I don't know. If you think of a portfolio of really high-risk stuff, and you think of lifetime losses versus 24 months, are those numbers going to be really different?
I don't actually, to be honest, because I think in essence, if you're looking at high-risk stuff, chances are your expectations are that that risk is going to come to realize quite quickly. Okay. And so in essence, you're expecting something to happen in a short term, so probably within a 24-month period.
I would make a distinction between default and expected loss.
I was asking Daryl.
No, I know. I would qualify his answer. I don't think it's 100% correct.
I would. Tom, final comment.
I like the fact that the staff is saying, give us permission to go look out at 12 and 24, in part because I seem to recall in some of our outreach very early on in this process that the banks talking about their own credit risk management systems, when they were talking about near-term losses, talked about ranges of periods of 12, 18, and 24 months, and some of it had to do with how long the loan was. And if they really are thinking about regularly in a credit risk management system that if they get a 7-year life loan or a 10-year life loan, that they're at 18 or 24 months rather than 12, I'd at least like to know what their credit risk management systems are doing rather than locking in necessarily at 12. But I understand the cookie jar problem that if we said at least 12, there's the possibility that they would goose it up just for cookie jar reserves. But
not just a possibility, but a plausibility.
Yes.
Commercial non-investment grade credits, which is largely what the banks are in, the public stuff defaults within about 3 to 3.5 years. So if that gives you a sense from the time you originate to the time you default, and to Pat's point, default doesn't mean full loss, but it gives you a sense of time frame. And you can apply that same kind of logic to this situation if you wanted to kind of do that math.
I just intuitively, I didn't
think. Intuitively, I thought the higher the risk, the closer it is to what it's going to.
I think that's fair.
Okay, let's try to round off this discussion. All right, PK?
If that is the case, if you make that the loan is going to go bad in next 24 months because it's already high risk, then the moment you move it to bucket two, you would not need anything because you already provided in while you're seeing it in next 24 months. So the point is that the cliff effect will not be needed here because you've already seen it next 24 months and you provided for it. You said it high enough, right? Yeah, but if it is,
you're going to have that in 12 months as well. It's just you're going to have half of it in year one, then half of year two, and then you're probably going to look to expect losses. So the cliff effect
is probably not there in either scenario.
Well,
that's what I'm saying. Cliff effect is there. You're shifting the cliff effect to the front end rather than to the back end if you do the aspect, right? Because you don't need anything in the – when you move to bucket two, and if I go by Daryl's comment that – you generally expect loans to go bad in 2 years' time frame, more than 1 year. Then you already provided for it, technically.
I'm going to give the floor to Leslie.
A couple of you have made the comment that if we get bucket two right, you don't need anything in bucket one. And I just want to register strong opposition to that. Again, we got to take ourselves broader than banks, first of all. And so putting yourself in the shoes of a different kind of an entity, I think that the way they think about this is to try and anticipate what the losses are going to be in the near term and record something. And with respect to the consternation about 12 months being arbitrary,
I mean, the way I think about it is that it is a practical way to deal with the losses that you priced into the loan. And so to the extent that the loan performs the way you expected, the 12 months is trying to say, here are the losses that I expect to occur in the next 12 months, and I'm going to recognize interest accordingly. To the extent that the loan starts to perform worse than you anticipated, it should move. And so, I realize that it's a bright line. I realize that it's, you know, a rule, et cetera. But I don't think it's completely without merit based on some of the discussions we had had about trying to relate the loss recognition to the pricing when it's performing.
Yeah, that works.
I agree. There's definitely some simplification to it, and but I have a harder time with 24 months explaining what we're doing.
Well, I would like to try to come to a conclusion now, because I think we have discussed the issues sufficiently, and I feel a broad consensus around the table, not complete, but broad. So I think, given the discussion, that we can probably answer the question A, which asks us to keep bucket one operationally simple, that most of us seem to support that. Do we need a vote on this?
Are you asking, does anybody...
Shall we ask for who disagrees? Who wants to... Yeah. Stephen?
Yes.
Stephen and PK? Fasby? Nobody. Then, if we agree with this overall recommendation, do we agree with the staff that methods A and B are the only methods that should be considered, so 12, 24 months?
Yes.
Yes. And C, do the boards agree with the staff recommendation to require the use of an annual loss rate as opposed to an annualized loss rate?
Yes.
Well,
I think, do the staff need more guidance to be able to continue their work? No?
I don't think so.
Okay, we have some extra time tomorrow, since we...
We had a payment on the agenda, we won't need it for tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay, we'll probably have to rearrange the since we gain time tomorrow, we'll rearrange the agenda a little bit. So everybody, yeah. Okay, we'll take a break now until.
Thanks, Rosemary and Matt. Thanks. Such a cool.